to call the February Services Committee meeting to order. Ask for a motion to approve the agenda. Mr. Forsyth, seconded by Mr. Hooper. All in favor? Any opposed? Motion carries. Approval of minutes from last month's meeting. Can I have a motion for the approval of last month's minutes? Mr. Arquette and Mr. Denisha. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Well, before we go any, Mr. LaPierre is excused this evening from this and the next meeting, actually. We have a presentation from the New York State Department of Veterans Affairs, and we'll welcome, is it Georgina?
Georgiana, yes.
Georgiana, I'd welcome her up.
Thank you. Do I need to turn this on? Okay. Sorry. All right. So, good evening, everybody. This is my coworker, Paul Ramesser, and my official slide clicker person. My name is Jordana Malik, and I work for the New York State Division of Veterans Affairs. We fall under the executive branch of New York State government. And this presentation is one of many that I'm doing at county supervisors, legislators across the North Country, with our goal being for there to be a better understanding of what we do at the Division of Veterans Affairs, how we serve veterans, and how we can fill in some of those gaps. So I'm learning as I travel that every county is structured differently and does things differently. So my goal is to sort of just provide an overview, take any questions you might have, and then for you to have my contact information in the future if there's a way for us to sort of fit in, however it might be. So all of the information that I'm briefing is current as of November 2017. Real quick about me. Army veteran myself. Are there any veterans in the room? I should have started by asking that question. Anyone? No? Okay. Behind me. Well, thank you for your service. So, Army veteran, still serving National Guard, and I truly love my job. I travel around the state, and I talk to people and try to connect veterans to the benefits that they have earned. Next slide, please. So, Army briefing style, I tell you what I'm going to tell you, and then I tell you it. That's what we're going to cover tonight. Next slide, please. So to understand kind of the lay of the land, I'm at the state. We've got 50 offices. We've got 50 benefits advisors on the county level. Sometimes these people are referred to as VSOs or veteran service officers, over 40 offices across New York State. And our job is to connect the benefits that they've earned. It might be federal benefits. It might be state benefits. Then we've got our county veteran service officers, and again, each county is structured differently. So here is your county veteran service officer, and then in some cases, we have our state benefits advisor is co-located with the county. Sometimes they're, in this case, our benefits advisor has offices in Ogdensburg and Messina within this county. And we have some counties that actually don't have any county service officers or any resources that they've put forward. So we fill that capacity. So it's a little bit different everywhere we go. Then you've got your chartered by Congress veteran service organizations. So your VFWs, American Legions, they each have their own specific criteria for membership. Different counties have different organizations represented. Just about all of them have some sort of statewide or department level organization as well. And then you've got the nonprofit sector. And that's what we've seen really evolve since with the post 9/11 era. We've just seen an increase in these nonprofit organizations, and they work to fill in the gaps in many cases of what the state or the federal government isn't able to provide. There is a specific program through the nonprofit sector, the SSVF program, Supportive Services for Veterans and Their Families. That came out of the initiative to end veterans homelessness, and the provider, every county has a provider for that program. So there's multiple layers, which as a veteran trying to navigate is absolutely challenging. And our goal, you know, certainly at the county level, at the state level, is to assist and support veterans through that process. Next slide, please. And then, on top of it all, we've got the federal VA. And we find that, so the federal VA is structured into three completely siloed separate organizations. And I mention this because oftentimes a veteran will have this experience where they've been going to the Veterans Hospital for a significant amount of time and they've got all their records, but they've been interacting with the Health Administration. Something transpires and now they're interacting with the Benefits Administration and they get a notice from the Benefits Administration that they need a copy of their paperwork. And they go absolutely crazy because they think to themselves, I have been going to this facility for the past 10 years. How can they not have my medical records? But in fact, the Health Administration and the Benefits Administration and the Cemetery Administration are three completely siloed organizations or agencies, I guess, within that larger Veterans Administration. So the Veterans community-based outreach clinics serve this area, and then all community-based outreach clinics are connected to sort of a mothership or a larger VA facility. In this case, veterans in this county would either be going to Syracuse or Albany, depending on, you know, the situation, geography, to receive care at a larger VA facility. Next slide, please. So what is a veteran? Because having multiple places to go for information isn't complicated enough, New York State has different definitions depending on the law as to what constitutes a veteran. So because in our offices we are looking to connect a veteran to federal benefits as well as state benefits, we utilize the federal definition. And at the bottom it explains, so it's discharged or released from under the conditions other than dishonorable. So there's different types of discharges that an individual can get. And according to this definition, if an individual has a dishonorable discharge, they are not defined as a veteran and therefore are not eligible for a lot of the benefits that we talk about. And I'll talk about the process that's in place to get that discharge upgraded. The DD-214 is sort of the key that unlocks everything. It provides the validation of that military service. This day and age, with digital copies, it's not really a significant issue with veterans getting discharged from the military and having access to their DD-214. But what we're seeing in previous generations of veterans, you know, maybe a parent or a grandparent is older, and now the son or the daughter is looking for that DD-214 because that individual is getting later on in life, they're looking for some additional care, and they don't have a copy anymore. So anybody can request a copy of their DD-214 through the archives.gov website. They can also go through our offices or through the county. A lot of times, veterans don't even realize that their DD-214 is in fact on file. It may have come directly from the military base where they were discharged, it's possible, or if at some point they interacted with any type of state benefit or county service, it's possible. So we say, tell families, check in with your veteran service officers first, see if we've got it on file. If not, we can assist you in getting a copy, because that document is critical for unlocking all of the veterans' benefits. Next slide. So here's just an example of some of the types of benefits that are available. I do presentations that are an hour and a half long where I just talk about veterans' benefits. The brochure that I handed out, and I have additional copies as well, gives you an overview of a little bit about what these are. We have a website and we have a mobile app. We have all kinds of ways to access this information. But just the importance at this point, I feel like, is just to recognize that whether it's for education, home ownership, later in life care, there's a wide spectrum of benefits that an individual may be entitled to. And it never hurts to ask. Next slide, please. So specifically talking about St. Lawrence County, all of the data that I'm using today is pulled from open source data from the VA's website, va.gov/vet data. And what I'm looking at on the left-hand side is your total number of veterans and what the projection is sort of long-term. Like most places in New York State, the projection is that the overall veterans population will decrease. The one thing, if you separate it out by male and female, you'll notice that the female population stays consistent. Females are the largest growing veterans population. More and more females are entering military service and then becoming discharged and then are entering the veterans population. So although the overall projection actually for the nation as well as New York State is that the overall veterans population will decline. The overall population of women veterans will continue to increase. And then also looking at the age bracket, because when you look at the types of services they might be using, whether it's veterans benefits or other county services, if you look over time, the age breakdown, that it's an aging population as you move forward. Next slide, please. So money into the county. What does this mean? The VA has a multiple different types of programs, some that put actual cash. So what I'm showing here, now this information is 2016. I haven't gotten 2017 information yet. But we look overall at New York State in terms of all of the VA funds that are coming in, education programs, home loans, compensation and pension, any type of program. That's the total amount for New York and then the total amount for St. Lawrence County. And there's about eight categories that the VA tracks. But the two that I took out are directly in terms of cash in pocket. So compensation and pension, that is, compensation is direct, a cash payment that is tax-free that a veteran receives for injuries that they sustained while they were on active duty. It's a monthly payment, and depending on the percentage and the type of rating, it could be anywhere from, you know, $100 to $3,000. Pension is, again, a cash payment that a veteran would be entitled to later on in life. A pension, the compensation is not tied to income in any way. An individual can have $1 million salary and they're still entitled to VA compensation if they received an injury during their military service. The pension is connected to income. It's a later in life benefit that a veteran may receive depending on if they qualify from an income perspective in military service. And then education and vocational rehab includes anything that goes into education funds for the veterans, including a survivor benefit. So the VA has programs that pay for surviving spouse as well as surviving children of veterans. It also includes vocational rehabilitation. So that's any adaptive material that a veteran needs. It might be something having to do with their housing, with their vehicle, computers. That is also money that's paid to colleges within the county. So that's direct funds that are either going into veterans' pockets to pay for education, or it's going to college and training programs to cover the cost of veterans. So all of this money is brought into the county by a combination of the Veterans Benefits Advisor we have here and your Veteran Service Officer, Mike. And the way to continue to sustain that is essentially through cooperation and collaboration, which is why I'm here. Our goal is to continually increase the number of veterans that we're connecting to their benefits. A lot of times we encounter veterans that just don't know that they're even entitled to something. Next slide. So a couple of things to keep in mind. If you're interested in tracking information about veterans who are receiving services, we always say it's better to ask the question on a form or in an interview, have you served versus are you a veteran? We find that a lot of times a veteran will discount their service, even though based on the previous definition, it doesn't say anything about combat or overseas. A lot of times a veteran will internally decide, well, I served during Vietnam, but I never went overseas, so I'm not really a veteran. Well, if they have an honorable discharge, they are. Or I've spoken to individuals who have said, well, I was overseas, but I never discharged my weapon, so I'm not a veteran. But none of that really matters. So you can get a more accurate data point if you ask the question, have you ever served in the military? Because it's more encompassing, and people won't discredit their service. A lot of times you'll hear someone say, well, I don't want to use the VA services because I want to save that for the veterans that really need it. I don't want to clog up the system. So the way the VA gets allocated money into each specific catchment area is by the number of enrollees. So I always tell people, if you don't think you're going to use the VA service, that's great. I need you to enroll because you might not use the service, but the federal government will allocate the same amount of money for that veteran that goes to the VA once a year for their annual exam to stay current as they do that veteran who's undergoing chemotherapy for prostate cancer from exposure to Agent Orange. And obviously, the resources that those two veterans use is completely different, but the money allocated is the same. So the more veterans that we can get enrolled in the system, the more we're able to allocate money to our catchment area, which is helpful. The other thing is that the VA does have income brackets in determining who, they have six tiers of who can receive care at the VA and what they pay. So someone will say, well, I make too much money anyway. That's fine, but if you enroll in the VA and they deny you, that system has registered there's a veteran in that area, which means when they look at allocating the community-based clinics or they look at expanding or closing hospitals, having accurate information is critical. So I always tell people, enroll in the VA. Even if you get denied, even if you're worried about clogging the system, it won't happen. Enroll in the VA and be counted, because it's critical to maintain that funding source into our catchment area. Agent Orange, Burn Pits, and Camp Lejeune. So the military did some things. They didn't know exactly what they were doing. Agent Orange, I think, is pretty familiar in terms of what happened during Vietnam. Veterans were exposed to Agent Orange. There's a series of side effects that both them and, in fact, their children, birth defects, that are a result of that exposure. They're entitled to compensation. They're entitled to medical care. If they die because of an Agent Orange-related condition, their surviving spouse is entitled to a cash payment until they remarry or pass away. So we know that there's veterans out there that have since passed away and never received the benefits that they had earned. So in order to try to remedy that, the burn pits, which is this current generation of veterans' malady or issue, is basically from exposure from the oil fields, from the burn pits that were on the military bases. They're seeing the long-term impact of that exposure. Maybe the veteran came home and had some bronchial issues, but long-term, they're developing other respiratory problems. So they've created a burn pit registry that any veteran that served post 9/11 can go in, fill in where they served and the dates of their service. And the VA is keeping a record of tracking those individuals in terms of the diseases that are present and are appearing within those populations. In the burn pit registry, it asks about symptoms, and sometimes a veteran won't even realize. It asks about heartburn, and they never make the connection that the heartburn has anything to do with the exposure to the burn pits. It may be, it may not be. But getting veterans into the burn pit registry is important in terms of getting accurate information about what's occurring medically within that population. And the last is Camp Lejeune. That's another area where the water was contaminated, and they're seeing the military families that were stationed there, as well as the service members. Individuals, there are certain dates and time frames. Those individuals, as well as their family members, are entitled to medical care at the VA. As I mentioned earlier, women veterans are the largest growing subgroup of veterans, and then the dishonorable discharge upgrade process. So our understanding this day and age of post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, even drug addiction is really different than during the Vietnam War and during previous conflicts. So there's individuals that may have gotten in trouble with the law or a superior officer that received a dishonorable discharge. But this, if that same incident had occurred at this point in the military, they would have received counseling for addiction. They may have received other services or medical treatment. So a group of veterans got together and essentially sued the Department of Defense and said, this is not fair. We want our discharges looked at because we had post-traumatic stress or traumatic brain injury, and it wasn't identified when we served. So through this process, it is possible basically to get that, or not basically, it is possible to get the dishonorable discharge upgraded. It is a paperwork process. It involves the veteran pulling together all of their medical records, submitting it to a board, it gets evaluated, and then that determination is made. Once their discharge has been upgraded and it's no longer dishonorable, they would then qualify for all of the benefits that I spoke about earlier. There is no, it's great and it's wonderful, except there's no master list of those dishonorably discharged veterans. They basically left, and the military felt like they were no longer responsible for them. So we have been working to try and reach these veterans. We've gone through county mental health, we've worked through the Coalition for the Homeless, and we've tried but there's no master list. So we're always looking for ways to just sort of spread the word about this program and to let individuals know. That pretty much concludes my formal part of the presentation. If it's possible to answer questions, I provided you with my card as well as that brochure, and that's all I've got.
So these nonprofits, what type of oversight takes place?
Not a lot, depending, and that is that's definitely a big issue. I'm sure you've seen in the news every so often where a nonprofit was taking money from veterans. Specifically for initiation of the SSVF grant, because it is a federal grant, they have to meet certain benchmarks. And I have seen in the evolution of the grant organizations that have had it and then don't get it renewed for the following year. But in terms of other nonprofits, you know, Charity Navigator or there's another guide, I think GuideStar, that provides ratings. I mean, they provide as much oversight as anyone else. Sometimes when there's problems, there are certain state laws that are relevant and pertinent that they're able to be held accountable with. But it's really just, up to the community, I feel like, in terms of good services and bad services. Word of mouth within the veterans community is very, I think it holds more weight sometimes than in other communities. I know that within the veterans community, there'd been a lot of discussion regarding the Wounded Warrior Project, and then it was, then it finally came to the forefront, and sort of the rest of the country responded, but it was something really that had been talked about for a while within the veterans community. So
there's no oversight process for them? I mean, they don't have to go through the Veterans Affairs to actually become a nonprofit?
So they have to go through the same process that anyone else does in terms of New York State to get the EIN number, and then, if they want that federal status to become the 501c3, they have to submit for the federal paperwork. And it's just the same evaluation of basically, they look at their mission that they state, and are they using their funds to meet that mission is the only criteria.
So it's almost like buyer beware.
It is, I think, buyer beware in many cases. I'm often contacted by organizations that want to put, links on our website, or they want, and we, the only links to resources you'll find on our website are state and federal resources. No more so than any other nonprofit is their regulation. There is an organization called Pathfinder, which is a website. It's almost like Yelp for veteran services. Or Angie's List, where veterans can go in and rate the services that they've got. And I've seen the traffic on that website pick up a lot more lately. So I think it's just kind of catching on. But, that's anecdotal experience at best.
Do you know how many nonprofits that are supporting veterans are here in St. Lawrence County? And can you tell me who they are?
So I can't give you a number in terms of nonprofits that exist that cover this area. So Clear Path for Veterans out of it's out of the Syracuse area, but I know that they did some work up here. Homeward Bound Adirondacks, which is out of Essex and Franklin County, I know that they include they sort of include their catchment area from Vermont to Fort Drum, so this would fall into that as well. Mike, I don't know, is there any other?
Soldier On.
Right, they're the company that has the SSVF contract for this area.
Okay.
And as far as the VA Wounds Program, the nonprofit out of Utica, Vet Center, they provide services.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Yes, sir.
Specifically on the health benefits, how does that coordinate with private insurance, Medicare, Medicaid?
So, a lot of it is dependent on the situation. So if a veteran is utilizing the insurance only for their service-connected issues, so let's say they have a back problem and they go to the VA to receive treatment for their back problem because it's connected to their military service. So they might use the VA only for that and then use their private insurance for everything else. There's eight different categories of of individuals that are using the VA for services. There might be somebody that uses the VA as their sole source of medical, basically medical insurance. They don't pay a premium every month to utilize it, but they would receive their care and then pay a cost share of it. If an individual is 100% service connected for one injury, they are entitled for care for other things as well. So it varies greatly. The other, the reality is that the VA only covers the individual. And so if that individual, in a lot of cases, has the opportunity to get medical insurance that will cover their entire family through their civilian employment, they oftentimes won't utilize the VA for care because it's not going to cover their family. So by no means is it a catch-all. In some unique situations, it can be incredibly beneficial, and in other situations, it's not so helpful.
On Medicare, or does the VA benefit still, because you know, you're eligible for Medicare at 65, is that, does that take over for what VA
They could
to?
Still receive their care at the VA, and there would be a billing process that would occur between the VA and Medicare, dependent on if they're utilizing the VA for a service connection or if it's another type of illness or injury. Okay, so I do appreciate your time. If anything that I've said you have questions about in the future, please, consider me a resource. My office happens to be in Raybrook, New York, which is not that far away, although I do cover outreach across the entire state of New York. So thank you very much for your time.
Okay, moving along with the presentation of resolutions, we have social services. First one, I need a motion for modifying the 2017 budget of social services for Medicaid surplus refunds. Mr. Forsyth, and second, Mr. Timmerman.
Okay, this proposed resolution has to do with a situation where there's a Medicaid spend down. Medicaid's a payer of last resort, so after Medicare, after the veterans. We have here a budget modification request in order to repay the state for expenses that medical assistance recipients, Medicaid recipients have had that have been paid for by the state, but the funds have been collected from the recipients. So there are situations where they're over the Medicaid income level, and they're required to make contributions toward the medical expenses.
Any discussion or questions for Chris? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The next one, I need a motion authorizing the chair to sign an agreement with the New York State Division of Criminal Justice Services for authorization to access criminal history record information. Mr. Timmerman, and seconded by Mr. Paikman.
This resolution is proposed to respond to federal requirement to access federal tax information, to access criminal histories of employees who are accessing federal tax information in the child support enforcement and collection context. We already have an agreement in place for background checks with DCJS for child welfare purposes, but this resolution would allow us to have an amended agreement to authorize DCJS to provide criminal history record information in connection with applications for employment. This would be for prospective employees. New York state law currently does not permit fingerprinting of certain employees as a condition of retaining their current job titles.
Yes, Mr. Lightfoot.
What safeguards are in place to prevent someone from accessing DCJS and getting information on you or me or somebody that they're not authorized to? make an inquiry about?
They are spelled out fairly clearly, and we have already some experience with them, making sure that we're only looking at data that we are allowed to look at. And we are very careful to make sure that every single search is, the records are kept on that, and we're auditing those records as well.
Well, that's a generic answer. I was looking for something a little more specific.
I did bring the agreement with me here, so I can go into more detail if that would be helpful.
Well, what I'm interested in is how do you prevent someone, or how are the records of people that they shouldn't be making inquiries about protected from access by people working in your social services department?
Right. Access is only allowed for certain people. The deputy commissioner actually is the registered person who has been trained in how to respond to this. And we have in the agreement a spelled out process for making sure that we're doing this correctly. I'm sure you want more details. I don't have them right at the top of my head. Yes.
So, Chris, in the first whereas, the way I started to read this was it says to enhance caseworker safety. And then the second whereas is actually dealing background checks with certain employees with federal tax. So I guess I thought there were two distinct different things, like you're sending out a caseworker to a home. Do you actually have background checks?
Right. So we
of
are
the actual individuals that, say, you've been put on this case. Do your caseworkers have access to who actually may be living in that home and their criminal background?
We are able, with the current agreement, to keep the caseworkers safe by doing background checks on those individuals. And that's the agreement that's already in place.
Okay.
This is an additional part of that agreement so that would allow also for that data to be used to do a criminal history record information background checks on the prospective employees who are using federal tax information in the child support enforcement collection context.
I guess I'm surprised that they're both in the same entity.
They're both in the same. The purposes are slightly different.
Yeah.
The agreement looks exactly the same, except
okay.
for a few words that allows for expanded use of the information.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, is there anybody in social services that monitors or audits the input to DCJS to see who's getting what information and making sure that it's a legitimate inquiry?
Heather Wenzel is designated as that person.
Who
yes.
is? Heather
the deputy
is?
Commissioner, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. And she does an extremely careful job with this and takes it very seriously.
Any other questions for Chris? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Next one, I need a motion for authorization to fill a social welfare examiner position in the Department of Social Services. Mr. Fay, second by Mr. Burke.
So this is a vacancy created by a promotion in the temporary assistance and supplemental nutrition assistance program unit. We have ongoing need to meet mandated deadlines for processing applications and recertifications, and there's a continuing high volume of work and a need for accuracy.
Any questions? Yes, Mr. Baker.
This is in the budget, Chris?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
So this is really a vacancy that's occurring because we have somebody moved into another position.
On this one and the next couple, it seems like we utilize the 60-day and the 30-day differently or something. This one's 100% reimbursable. I would think that would be the 30-day one. And some of the others are like 62%, and they're the 60-day ones. So,
Right. So this one is, you're right, that they do vary. And some of them are, we go with the 60 days unless it's absolutely not possible to do that in order to maintain what we need to do and to keep morale up. And that's why this is down for the 30 days. But there are others that are 60 days. Some of them are 60 days and it won't make much difference because the approval of the resolution will be there. We try very hard to only ask for the 60 days unless we absolutely need to have someone in the position right away in order to keep things going. And this is such an intense environment at this time. We are really wanting to make sure we fill this quickly.
Okay. No, I just noticed it.
Any other questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The next one, we need a motion for authorization to fill a caseworker position in the Department of Social Services. Mr. Arquette, seconded by anybody? Mr. Burke and Mr. Venetia.
So this is a caseworker position in the medical services part of the department. They're responsible for assessing the appropriateness of clients receiving home care and making sure that we've got cost-effective plans in place to take care of them. And the authorized services and ensure that the delivery is appropriate and the Medicaid billing is appropriate. This is also a position that's reimbursed at 100% and is open here because of a promotion.
Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The next one, we need a motion for authorization to fill a social welfare examiner position in the Department of Social Services.
This is another...
Arquette and Mr. Burke. Go ahead, Chris.
This proposed resolution is also for the temporary assistance and supplemental nutrition assistance program, an effort to make sure that we've got enough staff to ensure accuracy and effective processing of applications, and this is a vacancy that's empty because of a resignation.
Any questions, discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The next one, we need a motion for authorization to fill a caseworker position in the Department of Social Services.
This
Mr.
case.
Mr. Hooper and Mr. Paquin, second. Go ahead, Chris.
This caseworker position is in the child welfare area and is concerned with the preventive side. So after Child Protective Services caseworker has investigated a case, the most serious of those cases are indicated reports. Very frequently we're engaged with the families, the preventive caseworkers are involved, and are preventing out-of-home placements. It's very cost-effective to have these caseworkers carrying out this work, and they have their hands very full. This is a position that's vacant due to retirement, and it's also in the budget.
Any questions or discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The next one, we need a motion for authorization to fill a senior account clerk position in the Department of Social Services. Mr. Burke seconded. He's going to second. Mr. Denisha.
This position is also vacant because of a promotion. It is in the accounting unit, which is core part of the department. This is where the federal program claiming takes place, and the person who is involved with the state and federal reimbursement is in this role here. We are very fortunate to have such senior experienced staff in the accounting unit. This position is one of those key positions where we really are getting an awful lot of excellent work from the employees who've been out there, and is absolutely essential to make sure that we're doing the work correctly, that we're getting reimbursed, and the reimbursement for this position is very high at 81%, approximately, but the main value is that the work that they're doing ensures that we're able to claim the federal reimbursement on the programs.
Any discussion or questions for Chris? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Next one, we need a motion for authorization to abolish a social welfare examiner position and create and fill a community service worker position in the Department of Social Services. Mr. Timmerman, second by Mr. Burke.
So this proposed resolution is related to a vacancy created by someone being promoted into another position. We're reviewing the work that's done in this area. This is in medical services, and believe that the work can be accomplished with a lower title. In this case, it's a community service worker title that would be used. The work that is needed here is work that helps prepare applications to be reviewed by social welfare examiners, and I think this is a very effective way to make sure that we're responding to the need in this medical services arena. That it's reimbursed at 100%.
Yes, Mr. Timmerman.
I just want to thank you again and all of our county department heads for rethinking how we do things in the county and trying to make things more efficient for us. So thank you.
I echo that. Anybody else? Comments, questions for Chris? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The next one, we need a motion for authorization to fill a social welfare examiner position in the Department of Social Services. Mr. Hooper, seconded by Mr. Baker.
This position is that this resolution deals with is needed to ensure that wherever possible, a third-party health insurance is used rather than Medicaid, and we are using this position as a resource and liaison for doctors and hospitals and other medical providers that have billing issues. It's a very important position for the medical services unit, also reimbursed at 100%. And the vacancy is created by a resignation.
Any questions or discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The next one, we need a motion for authorization to create and fill a temporary legal secretary position in the Department of Social Services. Mr. Arquette and Mr. Denisha.
This position is a very cost-effective position. It's in the legal office, which is attempting to handle huge volumes of petitions and legal work, and they do a very successful job with that when they have enough legal secretaries. We are unfortunately dealing with a situation where we are going to be without a legal secretary for some time. We already have been and are wanting to have the ability to bring somebody in there temporarily to make sure that we can keep the work going. It's not clear exactly when the person will be returning or if.
Any questions? Yes, Mr. Akers.
So would this be the only one that you would have? Right now you're operating without? Or are there?
There are three in the legal office. Right now we have two, but they're using overtime and comp time trying to keep things going, and it's not working very well.
Okay. Are there people out there with that skill set that you anticipate that you can fill this?
I don't know exactly who would fill this yet. There's a list that will need to be referred to.
It's a civil service list.
Civil service list. So it'll be a little challenging given the temporary nature of the position, but we're hoping to be able to find someone because we really need to have somebody in there.
So, and you don't know the length of the temporary service either?
No, unfortunately, we have been anticipating that it was going to be shorter than it has been, and it looks now like it may be a while.
So do you anticipate that this could become a permanent position
or
replacement?
It's possible. I know it's so hard to tell with these things. I've been wrong before, but it's looking more likely, although I hope that's not the case.
Okay. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Motion carries. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you so much.
Now we move on to community services. We need a motion authorizing the chair to sign an agreement with Claxton Hepburn Medical Center for administering psychiatric examinations. Mr. Timmerman and Mr. Lightfoot. Jay, go ahead.
This is in accordance with the criminal procedure law 730 that the criminal courts of this county may order the director of community services to secure two qualified psychiatric examiners to examine a defendant to determine whether he or she is an incapacitated person. If deemed incapacitated and unable to participate in his or her own defense, the court may issue an order of observation and treatment at a forensic inpatient facility not to exceed 90 days. If the defendant is deemed to not be an incapacitated person, the criminal action will proceed. So we get quite a few of these from time to time. We had a rash of them when I first started. It seems to have slowed down a little bit. You know, it could be because somebody presents in an odd manner in front of the court that they have concern about their mental stability. It could be, you know, they committed a heinous crime that just the average person wouldn't behave that way. So they want the person examined to see if, you know, if they're of sound mind. I reached out to an adjacent county, and that contract provider in that county is charging $250 examination plus travel. This contract that is proposed with Claxton would charge us $126 for the examination per person.
Any questions for Jay? Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The next one, we need a motion authorizing the chair to sign a contract with Central New York Health Home Network, Inc. for care management services.
Okay, I'm not sure how long we've had.
Hold on, I'm sorry. Mr. Burke and seconded by Mr. Franklin. All right, go ahead, Jay. Sorry.
I'm not sure how long we've been doing business with Central New York Health Home, but I do know we have one care manager within our current mental health clinic. That's Ned Diaz. Currently, or 2017, the revenue for her services was $101,299, which is offset by her salary of $55,168. So it's an important service. It's kind of an in-home service. Most of the people that she serves are from referrals within the clinic. Don't necessarily have to be, but a lot of them tend to be. So it's necessary. If we weren't doing it in-house, we'd have to, you know, provide those same services through a contract agency. These clients that are being served through care management are typically higher risk of inpatient hospitalizations. So it's kind of a community-based wraparound service to support them in their home environment so they don't have to be admitted a hospital.
I would just take a moment and remind you, a couple of years ago when we adopted the 2016 budget, you took a gamble and reestablished a position of case manager in community services, and that's the one that Jay's referring to. So at the time, Central New York Health Homes was a new organization, a new focus of the way that care is being provided, and reestablishing that position has turned out well for the county.
Any questions or discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The next one, we need a motion authorizing the Director of Community Services to sign a data use agreement and business associate agreement with the New York State Department of Health and the Office of Health Insurance Programs for a performance management system. Mr. Timmerman, seconded by Mr. Burke.
Okay. This also is along the lines of the health home and the care management agencies. Provide care coordinators. That industry has changed quite a bit over the years. It used to be that the clinics had, within the clinics, embedded intensive case managers and supportive case managers. and billed straight Medicaid directly for those services. And there was a certain number of slots that each clinic was allowed to provide to meet the needs of the community. Those services were kind of unbundled, so to speak, by the Department of Health about 6-7 years ago, and allowed health home organizations to contract with community management agencies in the communities to provide care management. And what's happening is, one of the things that's inadvertently happening is, instead of going through SPOA, which is a single point of entry that's part of the LGU, they're circumventing that process and going directly to different providers, different hospitals, and trying to solicit business, because it is a business. And so what this is it's a fairly substantial and large database that the Department of Health has, and it would allow the DCSs, and I would also probably allow our SPOA coordinator and our AOT coordinator to also have access to this database. It would be two people that would be able to track how these care management agencies are functioning in terms of, at the time of the referral, how long does it take them to make contact, frequency of visits, and so forth. Not having been on the site or authorized to be on the site, I'm not fully privy to what exactly the information is on there. But this whole initiative was spearheaded by the Conference of Local Mental Hygiene Directors, because they felt it was important for the LGU to be able to have some oversight of these care management agencies and health homes.
Any questions or discussion? Yes, Mr. Akers.
Well, Jay, we don't have the CHA anymore, but we're required to still manage the outcome of these particular private entities that are actually running the CHAs, or am I confusing the two things here? Is this what this performance evaluation type thing is, to say, like how United Helpers or Health Services are providing these services to those that would be eligible if we still had a county-owned CHA?
I mean, I think there's channels that you'd have to go through if there were concerns. You know, I think Department of Health, once notified, would give some direction in terms of how they would want us to proceed in communicating with the health homes any concerns that may exist. For instance, currently, there's some community management agencies that are embedding into emergency rooms, okay, and trying to solicit business directly when people enter the emergency room for psychiatric or mental health crises. Trying to get them signed on for those particular services. One of the problems with that is the Department of Health mandates that the clients are to be given choice. And so if they're being solicited, when they're in a crisis and kind of, right, sign up for these services, they're not really familiar with what else is available out there. Another concern is waiver, which is a 1915C waiver, was to be going away in the middle of this year, and is going to be replaced by the waiver services are the most intensive services that you can provide children in the community, home-based wraparound services. And there's six specific services, and don't ask me verbatim what they are, but skill building and things like that for the families. And they come as a bundle in a waiver, and they were going to unbundle those and allowing the health homes to be able to pick which of those six services they felt were indicated for that family to receive in order to provide the necessary services. And they were going to bill Medicaid managed care organizations directly for those unbundled services. Well, that has since been pushed back to 2020. So the waiver, as we now know it, is going to stand on its own until that time. And typically, waiver is determined, those eligible and needing a waiver is determined through SPOA. So if people are being signed up through the health homes and aren't going through SPOA, who is, where are the firewalls, so to speak, that's determining, how are they determining whether or not that child needs waiver services and not necessarily appropriate for that particular health home?
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Berg.
The core function of SPOA in the mental health field is to serve as a clearinghouse for accessing case management and residential services, and I don't know if there's anything else, Jay, but
no.
But those two for sure, and so that agencies that have an individual sitting in the emergency room looking for business circumvents that whole process, and I think, but the SPOA was set up for that reason, so that you would have a group of people that would make objective decisions as to who best can provide the services and give the patient some choice as well.
Any other questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Next one, we need a motion authorizing the chair to sign a contract with Olicsoft Inc. for secure texting services for community services. Mr. Hooper, seconded by Mr. Timmerman.
So Clicksoft is an instant message. It's an internet-based instant message service that, if approved, we would contract with for $2,880 a year for 40 users. And what it is you know our clinicians and our support staff, and they sit in front of a computer screen all day long, except for when they're not at their desk. So what happens is, instead of having to go to see that person to ask them a question, what I found was a lot of the clinicians were just kind of just waiting in line behind the front desk people to give them information in terms of rescheduling a client or not, or the ins and outs of, you know, how often they wanted that person seen. And a lot of times the front desk people were on the phone, so they were just kind of standing in that front office area just waiting to speak to the front office staff. So this would allow them to instant message them, and what happens is you get a pop-up on the screen that says you have one or more instant messages, and you hit the icon and you bring up that particular conversation. So for instance, you know, for me, if I see somebody's taking some vacation time and they're in, you know, Governor or Messina, and I want to try to make sure that in their absence somebody's covering their group, you know, their treatment group or whatever, I can just IM them and ask them, as opposed to trying to catch them over the phone. And certainly, you know, in terms of sending emails, a lot of people don't check their emails, you know, until the end of the day, or sometimes not at all. So it chimes and reminds the person that, you know, there's a message for them waiting. So it just enhances the communication amongst, you know, all five of the clinics that we have.
Questions or discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. And the last one for Jay here, we need a motion for authorization to create and fill a keyboard specialist position in the Community Services Department. Mr. Lightfoot, seconded by Mr. Denisha.
Okay, this is a support staff position, and again, keyboard specialists, typically we use them at the front office. They interface with the general public when they come in the front door for services. They give them the referral packets to fill out, have them sign the releases and so forth. If it's a first-time appointment, they'll get the chart ready for the clinician. So they have a variety of functions, and really at some level kind of the heartbeat of making things go smoothly, you know, at the clinic. So they do not generate revenue, but they do support those who do. Right now, we currently have four keyboard specialists. One of those is specifically designated for the Ogdensburg Clinic. We have remaining three that are at the Canton Clinic, where we have both the CD and the mental health clinic. But one of those goes to Messina two times a week. So then that would leave us down to two. And what we're finding is we're having to pool other staff and sometimes billing staff up to the front window in order to cover, whether it's, you know, if you have one sick, then that's obviously a problem. But even if they have to leave early, you know, we have staggered their lunch, and that's helped some, so that, you know, we're not having to draw other staff into those positions. But we've just been kind of short with keyboard specialists and, you know, at the front window. And as we move forward, we're anticipating increased billable units of service. We're bringing additional staff on board, as you know. So the hypothesis is we're going to increase our numbers. And in doing so, we're going to need additional support staff for that.
Any questions? All in favor? Oh, sorry. Mr. Akers?
So, Ruth, where will the money have to come out of contingency for this, or where will it come from?
This will be created in the budget if you approve the resolution. And the idea being that with the increased volume, that you're going to see that cost covered by the department overall, not necessarily this particular position. But we'll watch that throughout the quarterly reports.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you.
Next, we have Office for the Aging. We have a discussion on transportation. Andrea?
Good evening. So on your desks, you will find some flyers, some pretty looking flyers of we're excited. St. Lawrence NYSARC, who is our operator of our public transportation, they sponsored a redesign the public transit logo contest for local students. And a student from SUNY Canton was the winner of the logo, and you'll see that design right there. So that design will be going out on all of the buses over the next year or so. We're excited about that, and they had over 40 submissions, so a lot of kids got really involved in this contest. It was a really nice thing. Another update about public transit. There's a lot going on. We're expanding rapidly. We have an average of 2,830 riders per month. And we look to those numbers to just be increasing over this next year. The Ogdensburg shuttle is a new shuttle that is starting February 26th. Again, you have that schedule. This is unique in that it will be offering transportation at all of our senior housing as well as low-income housing in Ogdensburg, and bringing these folks, as you can see, throughout Ogdensburg to all of the places that they may need to go, whether that should be shopping areas, hospitals, doctors' clinics, and those types of things. We plan to start a similar route in Messina within the year, because certainly, as we know, there's a great need for public transit and increased opportunities for our seniors, in particular our low-income individuals who cannot afford a car or car insurance. Also, we have currently just a reminder shuttles that are going on, public transit shuttles with SUNY Potsdam and Clarkson. Those are going really well. They're open when the students are looking to ride, so not on Sunday mornings at 7 a.m., but it's bringing them to our local businesses, shopping centers, banks, connecting them with hospitals, clinics, and those types of things. Very popular on the weekend. I believe service does stop around 9, though, so it's not a pickup for late night. Still have to take a cab or maybe an Uber for that, but students are loving it. We're having about 2,500 students a month ride on those shuttles. We're working on contracts with St. Lawrence and SUNY Canton for the same type of service for those students, as well as St. Lawrence NYSARC is working on a college connector route. Hopefully that'll be at some point in 2018. There's a lot of logistics to work out. But what we have found is that there's a lot of students who are taking classes at different colleges in the area, and they don't have a way to get there. So we're looking at a shuttle that would go all day long between the four colleges, allowing students increased opportunities at the different campuses. And last but not least, the First Mile, Last Mile program that we spoke about a while back is still happening. We're just waiting for official DOT approval. Just as a reminder what that is, that's really going to revolutionize public transit in St. Lawrence County. And as I can remind you, we are the pilot program for New York State for this. What it's going to do is that it will connect individuals from their homes to public transit. So they'll be able to call St. Lawrence NYSARC and say, I need to go to my doctor today at 10 o'clock, but the closest public transit is Rite Aid, which is 5 miles from my house. Can you come pick me up? So NYSARC is going to work with Volunteer Transportation Center, and a volunteer driver will come out at no cost to the client to provide them access to the public transit stop. Same type of return service can be scheduled as well. It's just like taking a, if you're in New York City and you take a transfer from a bus or a subway, all you pay is your $2 each way. We really look to this program to, as I said, really open up opportunities for individuals in St. Lawrence County over the next coming year. So DOT has given us verbal permission, but we have not received the official letter. And we're all set to go on terms of St. Lawrence, NYSARC, and VTC as soon as we receive the official word. DOT will be here reps next week, and I'm hoping they come on next Friday with some good news and a letter for us so we can get that service up and running.
Mr. Forsyth.
On that last, what sort of scheduling would you, say someone knows they have a doctor's appointment Friday at 10, would you want it a couple days?
Yeah, they're requesting it 48 hours in advance. I mean, certainly they'll make exceptions if they need to. I mean, if anything's emergent and it's like a 911 call, which those calls do come into public transit, somebody's trying to take a bus when they need to go to the hospital and it's an emergency. So they're going to request 48 hours notice to be connected. And it doesn't have to be just a doctor's appointment. It can be, I want to go to the bank, I want to go shopping, to the post office, to the DMV. Those types of things. So if they can give 48 hours notice, it'll be open when Volunteer Transportation Center and public transit is open. So tricky parts would be, you know, if it's trying to get a ride home at 10 or 11 o'clock at night. So during normal business operation hours.
So there's no income eligibility or anything?
There is not. It just connects you. The only thing it does is connects you to the public transit. So it's a connector route for public transit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
Any other questions on that? Thank you, Andrea.
Thank you.
We'll move in. Just one resolution for Office for the Aging. We need a motion modifying the 2018 budget to support St. Lawrence County public transportation with the acquisition of equipment. Mr. Arquette and seconded by Mr. Burke.
Okay, this is a resolution to modify our budget to purchase some new buses so that we can do all these wonderful opportunities that I just spoke about. The last buses were purchased in 2011, and actually DOT is behind in replacing our buses. We were due for these buses about 2 years ago, so we're running some buses that have over 300,000 miles on them. We have six public transit buses that are owned by the county. So there's two more that need to be purchased this year to replace the older fleet, and this resolution addresses that.
Any questions? Discussion? Yes, Mr. Akers.
Is it our county that actually our highway department that actually maintains these buses?
No, St. Lawrence NYSARC does.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
We have a couple resolutions here for public health. We need a motion authorizing the chair to sign an agreement with New York State Department of Health for early intervention services. Mr. Paquin and Ms. Bell.
I just want to introduce or remind you, Dana's here. This is her first day today. So Renee and Kendra have joined us one more time. But Dana's spent her first day at the office, made it through orientation, and a bit healthier than the last time you saw her.
We're all set on that. You guys can go ahead and discuss this first one, first resolution.
The first resolution is to sign an agreement for the early intervention program with the State Bureau of Early Intervention. This one started, was initiated 5 years ago when the state took over overseeing provider services for the early intervention program. It used to be that the county did it at the county level. 5 years ago, we entered into an agreement so that the state would oversee that responsibility.
Sorry. And so this is a renewal of that agreement. And they typically are a five-year agreement. So this is for us to provide early intervention services.
Any questions? Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
The next one, I need a motion for authorizing the chair to sign an immunization action plan grant contract between the Public Health Department and the New York State Department of Health. Mr. Burke, seconded by Ms. Bell.
So this resolution is for our mandated immunization action plan, and the grant is a five-year contract from April 1st, 18 through March 31st, 2023, and it's to provide education and reduce vaccine-preventable diseases among children and adults in our county.
Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. And the last one, we need a motion modifying the 2018 Public Health Department budget for the Emergency Preparedness Program. Mr. Hooper, seconded by Ms. Bell.
So this resolution is to purchase a, what they call a port account, a fit test machine, because we have to fit test every employee that could be used in an event of an emergency to prevent them from being exposed to airborne diseases. We're also required as an Article 28 health clinic to provide that fit test for each employee that would be used, that could be exposed to a disease that's airborne. And we are lucky to be able to use the emergency preparedness funds to purchase a new machine. Our machine was outdated and unusable.
Any questions? Mr. Akers?
What's the machine actually do?
It you put on a mask, and so it helps you decide which size masks to wear. And so you have to breathe with the mask on, and it will tell if any air particles are able to get into your face.
Thank you.
Anybody else? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies.
Chad, at this time, if Dana, would you... I asked you the last time, but you were quite ill, if you could talk to the rest of the legislators a little bit about yourself, your family, and where you hail from.
Oh, yeah, sure. I'm married, and I have a little girl who's going to be turning two in April. I was living in the Atlanta area for the last 2 years, and I've been at the CDC. But my husband works at SUNY Potsdam, so we've moved back here. Today was my first day. And for the last 6 months or so, I've been traveling back and forth, so I've still been working at the CDC, but I've been doing kind of the back and forth thing. I worked at the activity branch, so looking at the guidelines, like for how active we should be. And then most recently, I've been working like in the disabilities area and doing the surveillance of kids who have autism. So that's been my area. I've been here in the North Country previously. I first moved up here for my first job as a PT. So I worked here for a while, and then I moved to Boston, and then I came back here, and then I went to Clarkson University, where I used to teach in the PT program. Then I moved to Rochester, and that's where my family lives, and I went to get my PhD at the University of Rochester, and that's what brought me to the CDC, and that's what brings me here. So do you have any questions for me?
You're ready to set down some roots, right?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, welcome.
Yeah, thanks very much. Thank you. Oh, the executive on the other. Yep.
So,
we're going to adjourn.
We're adjourned.